you can have a parent who is incredibly ambitious for you, but it always has to be their fucking way. You know, you always fall short and they're kind of slightly critical to you. They fucking rave about you behind your back, right? Yeah. When their friends are like, oh, how's Mickey? Oh, amazing. She's got a front cover of this and blah, blah, blah. But when you're talking face to face with them, they're like, well, you know, I don't really understand why you don't do this, or you don't, you know, some ignorant bullshit that they're trying to advise you on your career. And you're like, okay, you don't have the first idea of what I'm actually doing here. So just shut the fuck up. You know, the irony is that if I had married some fucking banker or some tech fucking billionaire or something, he would have been hypercritical of them as well. And gone, well, I don't understand why you married this stiff.
I'm Matthew Philp.
I'm Elizabeth Thompson.
And I'm Erin Hosier.
And this is Tell Me About Your Father, a podcast about daddy issues, father figures, and dismantling the paternal mystique.
We examine how fathers, both literal and symbolic, influence pop culture, politics, and the lives of people of every generation from all over the world.
So settle in and listen as we delve into some dad stuff. I'm Erin Hosier. On this episode of Tell Me About Your Father, Elizabeth and I talk to indie rock, dream pop, shoegaze heroine Mickey Brenyi of the 90s band Lush about her universally acclaimed memoir, Fingers Crossed, now available in paperback in the U.S., that Rolling Stone's Rob Sheffield called his favorite book of 2022, and Rough Trade called one of the best autobiographies ever. Mickey is the only daughter of a Hungarian sports journalist father, Ivan, and a Japanese actress, Yasuko Nagazumi, known then as a Bond girl in You Only Live Twice. Her parents divorced early in Mickey's life, and while her mom moved to LA with a stuntman stepdad, Mickey stayed behind in the UK to be raised by her eccentric father and his abusive, Nazi-sympathizing mother, Nora. Part one of the memoir begins with Mickey's dad trying to toss her into the Mediterranean as a baby to teach her how to swim, and ends with Mickey uncovering a jaw-dropping family secret. Part two focuses on the post-punk DIY new wave scene in London in the 80s that saw Mickey and her best friend Emma Anderson start a band that ended up having an enormous influence on people like me and Kurt Cobain, and saw Lush headline Lollapalooza in 1992. In this interview, Mickey tells us about the agonies and ecstasies of a life with a boundaryless, hard-partying, single dad at the helm, and the perils of being treated like an adult when you're six, and also their shared experience being raised by Mickey's granny from hell, which Mickey didn't know about until the end of her father's life. After the ongoing European shows, you can see Mickey play live in the U.S. with the Mickey Brenyi Trio, beginning May 29th in L.A. at the Fonda Theater, ending June 8th at NYC's Webster Hall. And her memoir, Fingers Crossed, How Music Saved Me from Success, is available everywhere books are sold in English. Here's more of our conversation with Mickey.
So my dad was born in 1933 in Hungary. My mom was born a decade later in Japan. And I would just say that I realized that there's a kind of, you know, a lot of the stuff in the book is quite shocking. And there is this idea of this terrible childhood. I always have to balance this and say that, there was lots of stuff. It was just extreme. Like the bad was really bad.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of really good stuff. And, you know, I do feel kind of bad about, you know, I certainly didn't set out to write any kind of a misery memoir where it was like, look at my terrible, you know, the scars and the pain and all of that. It's absolutely not that kind of book.
No.
And I think my parents were kind of war babies. My dad, you know, went through the Hungarian Revolution. My mum was brought up in a much, you know, very traditional Japanese. They were both very middle class. So they had certain privileges. And I think, you know, my mum had quite a lot of expectations of her. You know, I mean, they all but had like kind of, it was pretty much like arranged marriage really in Japan at that time for that class of women. And, you know, she rebelled and, you know, there was nothing terrible about it. I mean, it wasn't like they were going to sell her off to some terrible husband, but it was traditional. Right. It was like her mother had married a doctor and they had this very sort of stable middle-class life, although the war had created all sorts of difficulties for them, which they survived. And, you know, my mum was being prescribed a life, same thing, you know, her brother became a doctor. That was what was expected of him. Whatever else, other ideas he had, didn't matter. And she was treated the same way. It was like, well, you will be a doctor's wife and blah, blah, blah. And she met my dad. So my dad had come over in 56 when there was the kind of revolution in Hungary, when the Soviets came in and occupied, and there was a rebellion and uprising, and he came over, as many, many, many Hungarians fled the country at that particular time. And he settled in Britain and did his degree, and he kind of went into journalism, sports journalism specifically. And so he went to the Tokyo Olympics in 1964. And my mum was like, if I say hostess, that has really dark connotations. It wasn't that at all. You know, they got a lot of university students and people who actually spoke English, you know, which was relatively rare.
Yeah.
And because she was a student and she was studying English and she, you know, so she got stationed at the Prince Hotel or something. You know, you stand around in a kimono and tell tourists where to go or whatever. And, you know, that was her job. But my dad kind of, you know, this is where their kind of worlds collided, because he was out there reporting on it. And, you know, my dad was a very hedonistic person, loved, I mean, basically shagging around effectively and having girlfriends and stuff. And it was the 60s, you know, he'd been in London and it was all kind of swinging and all of that. So
yeah,
when he met Yasko, my mother, my dad was Ivan. When they met, he was actually kind of having a bit of a thing with a friend of hers. So initially they were just friends. And after the Olympics were over, they kind of corresponded, ostensibly because she was wanting to learn English and practice her English and blah, blah, blah. But at that point, my dad decided that he hadn't seen his father since he was three, you know, during the war.
Yeah.
So, and he'd actually gone to live in Australia. So he decided to track his father down and visit him. And I think, you know, the way my dad tells it, and my mom actually, that journey where they were corresponding. And so I guess he was kind of on his own and having adventures, and they were writing these letters to each other. It was quite romantic. And my dad said that he would, you know, get to Baghdad or somewhere and go to the post office, and there'd be a letter waiting for him from my mother. And basically this romance kind of burgeoned during this sort of epic journey across land effectively to Australia. I mean, the last bit clearly by boat, but you know, you travel all across the continent. And by the time he kind of got back to London, they were in love, and she basically eloped. She just went out to get a haircut one day and then got on a plane and rocked up in London. And she was only 24.
Yeah.
She was very young. And they got married and it was quite whirlwind. But you know, I don't think either of them really knew what they were taking on, which I suppose is the point of a whirlwind romance, really. You know,
yeah.
I think although my mum was 10 years younger than my dad, she's quite an opinionated person. She doesn't take a lot of shit. She'll put up with it for a while. But, you know, when she snaps, it's like, right, that's it. And, you know, equally, my mum just didn't expect my dad to be this sort of womanizing, feckless kind of,
yeah,
you know, person, like genuinely thought, you know, like all Japanese men, that when you get married and you have a child, you will settle down and you will take life seriously. And, you know, and yeah, that didn't happen. So they split up when I was quite young.
The book opens with him throwing you into the Mediterranean when you were like a baby.
I was like two or three.
And that sort of sets the tone. And it's funny. There's humor in it. I think one of the things that makes the book so funny is like throughout the story you're about to tell, throughout your life, you're kind of like pushing back with your bewilderment of the behavior of these adults that are supposed to care for you. So your parents, how long were they married?
I mean, not very long, like probably all of like 4 or 5 years, you know. Yeah. I think I was about 4 when they split up. And I think, you know, even that story about being chucked into the Mediterranean, you know, my dad used to tell that bloody story all the time, right?
Yeah.
And his point was, you know, so this is the thing, you know, his point was he thought he was doing something good. You know, he was like, he said, well, that's how I learned to swim. I got thrown into the Lake Balaton, which is in Hungary, and he lived on the shore there. They had like a villa there. And I was like, I know, but that's a lake, right? That is about 3 foot deep for the first 200 yards. This is the fucking Mediterranean Sea, all right? And
yeah.
And, you know, he was like, oh, you know, if your mother hadn't stopped me, you know, and kind of told me off and all of that, you would have been an Olympic swimmer by now. You know, it's like, right, okay, it's not actually how this works. But, you know, so the intention was good, which is really my dad's life story. There's a lot of good intentions, quite selfishly framed, right? You know, anyone want to ask me whether I actually wanted to be an Olympic swimmer? You know, that was more my dad's dream. And I think his sort of behavior was that kind of a person who does these things and just leaves this trail of destruction behind him. Like, none of it is cruel or intentional, but actually it's like, yeah, there's just this mess everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
That he just expects other people to just kind of tolerate and survive. You know, what's the problem?
Mickey, what stuck out to me reading the book was how at such a young age, I mean, some of your earliest memories are sort of, you say, watching your parents' marriage dissolve and your awareness that your mother was unhappy in the marriage. And I just was blown away by how much grace you give to a father that you describe perfectly as having, quote, a lifelong habit of being self-servingly economical with the truth. And I think that it really captures out of the gates of telling Ivan's story that he is this charismatic writer. You know, he's a journalist.
Yeah.
He's a womanizer, which, you know, he's literally, your mother tells you at your birth, not there, because she assumes that he was out with someone else. She tells you at that moment she lowered her standards of him. But this is all to say that you seemingly have an awareness at a very young age of both of your parents about who they are and being okay. I mean, accepting who they are and making do with who they are, not dreaming that, you know, I didn't get the sense that you were dreaming as a child that you could change them. Did you feel that? Is that the correct read of your writing there? Like, did you want to come home to, you know, a different kind of dad or a mom that was more present, literally, and closer in the States to you, or in the UK to you? Or did you know at a young age, like, these are my people and this is what I have to deal with here?
I mean, I think, you know, certainly when I got a bit older, you know, as a kind of teenager, I was much more critical of them. But I think when I was young and when they were divorcing, I was totally accepting of who they were and, you know, quite biddable, really. You know, I didn't really question that there was anything wrong going on or blame them in any kind of way, which I don't think is uncommon in small children. But I think if you compound that with the fact that I was an only child, so there weren't siblings to maybe get that kind of, you know, older siblings to get that sense of how things might be wrong. I think the fact that they were divorcing and I was between them, I kind of learned quite early on that it's quite difficult to play parents off each other when they're already split up, because there's always the threat that one or the other might, like, they go too far. Like, if I slagged off, you know, my dad to my mum, it would almost be like, oh shit, is she going to take me away from him? I mean, she'd be perfectly justified in doing that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you don't want to rock the boat too much. Because, like, you know, unusually, although they split up, I was very much between them. The time was very shared. So there was never any question that I was just going to go and live with one of them. And to be honest, if my mum hadn't, you know, first moved out of London and then moved to America, I don't think that would have ever happened. I think I would have just lived between them. And I was sort of accepted that arrangement because it seemed like a pretty decent compromise. And, you know, the other factor is clearly, you know, Ivan's mother, Nora, who was very against my mother and was constantly demonizing her and saying awful things. And the thing is, you know, that actually makes you more loyal. If it didn't work, if her intention was to put me against my mother, it actually had the opposite effect. And I stuck up for her way more.
Yeah.
And so I don't think, I certainly had no awareness that anything was particularly bad. I mean, you know, add to that that my mother became an actress and a model. That was very glamorous. And, you know, there's a kind of, you know, you're a bit dazzled by that even as a child. You recognize that that has currency. And also that my dad was like, he was fucking great fun, right?
Yeah, yeah. That comes through. Yeah.
You know, he could be a bully and he could be neglectful and he could be irresponsible. But the point is that when he took you on these adventures, which were selfishly motivated, and he'd go, come on, it's going to be fun. He was kind of right. Right. He would make it fun. Actually, so it was quite hard to sort of refute a lot of it because, you know, he did hold up that side of the bargain by making it a good fucking laugh, basically.
So they divorce and she's still in London for a few years, right? And then she goes to LA.
Yeah. So she, first of all, she was living in London. Then when she met Ray Austin, who was a kind of,
your stepfather.
You know, yeah, my stepdad. They got married when I was about 8. They moved to Windsor, which is kind of just, it's about half hour drive out of London. It's not that far, but they kind of had a life there. And I was there till I was about 11. And then because of Ray's career, they moved to America and they moved to Hollywood. And I think that was very difficult, actually. You know, I think that's where things really started to go a bit wrong for me, really.
Yeah, because you had to kind of make that choice, right? That choice when your parents are divorcing, like, who are you going to live with? And in your case, it was the difference between two countries. But also, do I want life with dad or do I want life with mom and Ray in America? So what went into that decision for you?
My dad, I remember telling me about the actual events. Like, he said that basically it was him who kind of kicked up a fuss and he got a lawyer and decided to fight for custody. And it ended up with this lawyer basically saying, well, she's going to have to decide, right? Where does she want to go? And my dad, I mean, he did say he felt terrible about it. You know, he did feel that that was a huge pressure to put me under. But he just felt like he didn't have any choice because Mum and Ray had the money. I'd been living with them largely in Windsor. I was by then at school in Windsor and most of my life was with them. I spent the holidays and weekends with my dad. And I think he felt that, quite understandably, that if I went to America, he'd barely see me, if ever, really. And I do appreciate that, you know, and I always felt, as problematic as my life with my dad was, I do, you know, this is the 70s, right? And the early 80s. And I do have friends who are the product of a first marriage, a man who then, when, you know, the parents divorced, the man went on to have another relationship and they pretty much abandoned their children, right? Which is exactly what Ray did, actually. You know, he'd had like fucking 5-6 children.
Yeah.
And they were all kind of jettisoned, apart from my stepsisters, my two stepsisters. But, you know, he had two sons from a first marriage, a son from a second relationship. He never saw them, you know.
Right.
And I felt that, you know, at least my dad did fight for me and he did want to hold on to me. And that did mean a lot because he could have just thought, all right, fuck it, I'll just meet someone else and have another kid.
There's not a lot of single fathers, you know, even now, who have primary custody. I mean, it must have been kind of a special thing.
I mean, it was very hard for my mother, but, you know.
Yeah.
I think she tried to woo me to come and live in America and kept, you know, taking me to Disneyland and, you know, their fabulous house in Hollywood and all of that. But I just think I'd had kind of enough disruption by then, if I'm honest. You know, I'd been to five different schools and, you know, trying to keep up with my parents' fucking movements. I just didn't really like Ray very much. I mean, I didn't hate him. I just didn't really like him.
Well, let's talk about Ray a little bit for a second, your stepfather. Just for context for our listeners, your mother meets this English television director. Had he acted too?
Was he like a...
Well, he actually started off as a stuntman in Britain. Well, in Britain. So he was in the 1960s, he was in like the Avengers. Mm-hmm. He taught, you know, Diana Rigg, her kind of kung fu stuff. That kind of like 60s world of television was quite... There was a certain sort of meritocracy to it. Do you know what I mean? There were lots of people from different backgrounds who could break into that. And, you know, he had a pretty illustrious career as a stuntman. He got sent to LA, I guess it would have been like the 60s or something. You know, he was like Cary Grant's chauffeur and gopher and was the stunt double in North by Northwest. And he was in fucking Ben-Hur and do you know what I mean? And was, I mean, I'm not being funny, but clearly shagging a lot of fucking actresses and actors, I think. He was, and I think what happened is he kind of fucked it up because he had an affair with Cary Grant's wife. And that was a step too far and he got kicked out of Hollywood.
Incredible. And your mom was an actress.
Yeah. So I think, you know, she was doing a bit of TV acting. You know, she was in You Only Live Twice. So she got offered the part.
Yeah.
In the one with the Japanese people in it. Right. You know, and, I mean, but that was really her acting career, you know, typecast as, you know, Vietnamese, Singaporean, whatever the fuck, you know what I mean? East Asian, that's it, you know? And I think she quite enjoyed it, but she kind of acknowledges herself that she didn't consider herself much of an actress. It was great. It was fun. It was glamorous. And then when she met Ray, she was very happy to give it up.
Yeah.
Well, and in that sense too, I think reading part one of the book, you know, as a reader, I want so desperately to just take you away from what you're going through at home with your grandmother and with your father and the chaos there, but then also the sort of heartache that you feel around your mother's remarriage to this man who also a larger than life charismatic figure, but who really dictates the tone of the home, right? It's his rules. He decides where you go to school. He kind of disrupts your life in that way. And also there's an amazing scene where I think you curse at him and he pretends to have a heart attack. So
yeah, and Ray and his heart attacks. Yeah,
real mature Ray.
I mean, I did find Ray quite fascinating because he had such an interesting life. His real story was fascinating. You know, he was born in complete poverty and to have kind of achieved what he did and have this career and go end up in Hollywood. But it was so weird. Like when he got to Hollywood, he just got all these weird pretensions. And after he split from my mom, I mean, he's dead now. So, you know, whatever. He died quite recently. He bought himself like a title, right? Lord, Baron, Devlin, whatever the fuck it was. And literally, you know, had like portraits on the wall that he would claim were his ancestors. And it was this weird sort of fantasy. And I remember sort of thinking it's so weird. Like it taught me a little bit about kind of class, which I didn't really understand because I'm not British technically, you know, I wasn't brought up as that. And I think that idea that I thought, you've got such an interesting life and such an interesting history, why would you erase that to make up some what is ostensibly quite a dull, blue-blooded life of privilege? Why would that even be attractive when you've done so much, you know? And I think he had quite a lot of insecurities. Like, I mean, I personally think he had, you know, who knows why people end up how they were. You know, I know he'd been in the Korean War. I know that had really fucked him up. It's difficult, isn't it? Because we throw around these words now, like narcissist or, you know, whatever the fuck. I do think there was something slightly wrong with him. I don't think it was totally normal. And I just think that false exterior that he put up, which we all had to play along with, you know, my mum had to play along with, was like he wasn't happy in his own skin. You know, he had to invent this person, who he was. And I think part of that entailed a lot of kind of denial, you know, never mind erasing his own history, but even about his children. About, you know, these past marriages. It was always just kind of, never mind all that. This is me now, right? This is where I am. And it's that constant reinventing yourself. And my dad was the total opposite. He was very happy in his own skin. And he had no pretensions in that way at all, right? He just thought that kind of, even with his own mother, He thought all that middle-class Hungarian pretentious sort of claim to kind of any nobility, like the name Bereni, the YI is almost like, you know, of. So it's like von whatever or de whatever. Do you know what I mean? In different languages. So people always say, oh, Bereni. Oh, that's kind of a classy name because it, you know, shows that. And my dad would always scoff at that and go like, fuck off. You know, it's just fucking ludicrous, meaningless, you know. So it's interesting that the working class guy had all the pretensions and the guy who was actually born into middle class life was just like, well, it's all fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
So I didn't have much time for Ray on that level because I just thought it was phony.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Why are you pretending to be this person that you're not?
Yeah. And then you also simultaneously talking about your father was way more kind of in tune with who he really was. But to go in this direction in the interview, this added level of secrecy and denial that was happening in your home with your father, which was around the abuse that you were experiencing from your grandmother, who you shared a bed with as a little girl and who you have memories of what you can now see being an adult were sexual molestation from your grandmother. And, you know, that I don't even think you really as a child knew, most children don't. You really beautifully write about feeling of thinking as a child that this was something that you were complicit in and that you couldn't have been a victim in that situation because you must have instigated this somehow is I believe what you write. And so you have this really incredible view of it now as an adult and I feel like healthy view of it. But then that's met with an attempt to talk to your father about it later and he can't hear it in the moment. Later you have another conversation, which we'll get to, but he couldn't go there on that level with you, right?
I mean, I think when I was a child, he just was kind of blind to it. And I think that it was such a chaotic household. When I look back at Nora's abuse and, you know, I mean, in the book, it eventually turns out that, you know, she did the same to Ivan when he was a child, you know, and this was the kind of big reveal, you know, that we never really talked about that. He only told me about that when he was very close to dying. And I think, again, his sort of, it is a kind of denial in the, because I did say to him, what were you thinking bringing her over here if that had happened to you? And he was like, well, I didn't think she'd do it to you because you're a girl. And I thought, okay, so you're confusing lesbianism and heterosexuality with abuse. It's like a whole... But I could understand that his generation really didn't understand, you know, that kind of stuff. And to be fair to my dad, it's quite interesting that after he died, there's a number of friends of his, or two in particular, who told me he did tell them about that when they were in their 30s and, you know, coming over to London or whatever. He did actually, and I think he had, you know, some sort of sexual hang-ups, because he always said his mate Gabby, he said, oh, well, I'm so grateful to Gobby, who was a fucking crazy friend of his. He said, he just took me to Europe and made me fuck everything that moved and it cured me, inverted commas.
Right.
This is like an old school way of dealing with psychological problems. And I think, you know, he kind of felt that, I mean, I guess he felt selfishly that, you know, whatever he survived is survivable. You know, I genuinely don't think he thought that she was abusing me. And the thing is that Nora, I always say that she wasn't a, I mean, I'm not an expert, right? But to me, she wasn't like a predatory paedophile. You know, she was not after my friends or my dad's friends or anything. She was just a total fucking controlling, toxic person in that way. So she had her son, she had her granddaughter, and she just fucking wanted you to herself in every possible way. Okay. And really, I think that was her motivation. And I think, regardless of the fact that my dad wasn't aware of, you know, the kind of sexual abuse when I was a child, you know, I was angry with him for not recognizing the mental abuse, you know.
Yeah.
And I think because I was quite a brat, I mean, as you said, I swore once at Ray. You know, I just thought swearing is quite normalised to me, right? So as a kid, you know, when he pissed me off at once, I just went, oh, fuck off. And he went fucking crazy, understandably, right? But I was quite bratty, you know, I was quite out of control. And I think my dad thought that I could give as good as I could get. He wasn't sitting there thinking, well, this is clearly like a six-year-old child with a fucking mad grandmother who is, you know, like not really an appropriate adult, right?
Yeah.
He was just like, oh, she'll be fine. Look at her. She's quite spunky and she knows how to fight back and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, you describe her as an abnormal adult who had unfettered access to you. And that's very true. And also, I think what a very poignant part of that paragraph is you say, and this was the only family that I had. Yes, I was angry as an adult, but this was my family. And to your point about Nora, too, I mean, yes, Aaron, on page 5, we're hearing about Nora was talking about, you know, what a great guy Hitler was and the Nazis. And, you know,
there's that
saying,
aspect.
Saying totally insane shit about that. And then, you know, and then but also this deeply lonely woman who was just obsessed with hating your mother, Mickey, and telling you sort of all of these fantasy lies about your mother. But then also just the typical, like, the caricature of a scared woman, like, someone's followed me home and telling you about that. I'm very suspicious of the neighbors. And, you know, you're just a little kid having to endure all of this stuff, listen to this. And so then there are moments where your dad would sort of cast his light on you and say, why don't you come out for a night on the town with me? So, you know, how old were you going to bars with your dad? Just to get away from her.
I mean, to be fair, when my dad would take me out to like parties and clubs and things, it's not like I wanted to get away from her in that, like, oh my God, don't leave me with her, that woman, you know?
Right.
It was more that I was like, I want to come. You know, because I didn't, you know, I was allowed to fucking stay up all night if I wanted to. There was no rules in that house in Staverton Road.
It feels like you and your dad are like the same age and growing up as you go, you know?
Yeah. And he was like, you know, because he always said to me, like, I always treated you like an adult. And my riposte would be like, right, but I wasn't an adult. Right? You know, that's the fucking problem.
Important distinction.
And I think that, you know, Nora really didn't start to drive me completely insane until I was a little bit older, you know, certainly when I was a teenager. I just couldn't bear to be around her. But whether that's her getting worse or whether that's me becoming a teenager, you know, that's all bound up in that. I think Nora was just very cloying and she could be very sweet. She could be a classic grandmother doing colouring in and blah, 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 cooking and all of those nice things. But it was always, there was this undercurrent of darkness, of filling my head with terrible things about my mother, talking to Jesus all the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, if any transgression, it was like, Jesus is watching you and he can see and la, la, fucking la, right? And also, you know, hated women. All my dad's girlfriends, she would say the most awful things about them. I mean, genuinely fucking really graphic and nasty. And also just very, very good at mind games, you know, would say things like, well, you know, when you were out of the room, you know, you think that person's so great, but they were saying what a horrible child you are and all of that. And, you know, when you're like six or something, you know, you haven't really got the kind of artillery to fight that. And she was very bitter and she was very unhappy. She was a snob. She was a Nazi. And, you know, I get it. I mean, funny enough, I was doing an interview with a woman who was from Germany. And she did say, like, yeah, I had a Nazi grandmother. We were sort of discussing. It's funny, like, when you talk to people in the West, they're like, oh my God, your grandmother was a Nazi. It's that uncommon. But if you come from certain countries, you might have had a grandmother who was a Nazi.
I
didn't even think of it that way, because a huge twist at the end of your dad's life that you learned, was this in 2007 when you learn his heritage, his father? Who was his father?
Well, his father, who was Paul Brenny, and I can only rely on my dad's account of this, but I think he was from a wealthy family. And the story is that, you know, he was a playboy and a gambler, but he had that kind of charm and what have you. So the family agreed they were going to get married, blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't till the wedding that they realized they were actually fucking Jewish, right? So, and it was a bit of a scandal.
No.
But, you know, clearly they accepted that and they went along. And it's quite, you know, I'm not going to go into the whole history of Hungary and how it treated its Jews. But, you know, there is a sort of tipping point with Hungary where they actually, Jews were very integrated into Hungarian society, certainly during the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And really it was the kind of Hungary's allegiance with Germany during the, you know, Second World War, when eventually the Germans were kind of like, no, you have to start cracking down on the Jews and you have to start bringing in these laws. So I would argue that it was slightly reluctant. I'm not going to play down the anti-Semitism, because when it finally broke through, it was fucking unforgiving and appalling. But I don't think that there was like a long history of anti-Semitism in Hungary. So when Nora and Paul got married, it was a bit scandalous, but clearly it was fine because Ivan was born and, you know, that went ahead. The real problem was that he gambled away all his fucking money and became like a kind of pariah to the family, not just Nora's family, but also to his own. And they all put him on a fucking train and told him to get the fuck out, basically, and sent him off to Australia.
Mm-hmm. Did Ivan ever see him ever again after he was three?
I think it was when he... So I guess part of packing him off was also because of the creep of anti-Semitism that was clearly getting worse. But I think, you know, that was when my dad met my mum, and that's when he made that trip to Australia to find him. And classic Ivan, he said, fuck me, you know, I went all that way. And he said, oh, the guy was a fucking asshole. But then, you know, then that was the end of that.
That was the end of that.
He
describes him as oafish and charmless. You know, a blah that he doesn't really care to, you know, he's sort of underwhelmed by the experience of meeting him.
Well, and then that's back to my point that, you know, that was a father who thought, you know what, I've made a new life in Australia. I've got a new family. You know, I have no interest in you. I know you're my son, but I've got a new life here and I'm just not interested in you. And, you know, maybe that is why he was so, I mean, not protected, but you know what I mean? So desperate to hold on to me, because his own father had abandoned him and he knew how hurtful that was. He kind of made light of it, but fuck's sake, he had traveled halfway across the globe, you know, to find him and was met with rejection, basically.
Yeah. I liked, Mickey, that there are a couple moments in part one of the book where you do, I think your father does see you as a teenage girl, like especially when you're so upset about having to leave the school. One that you really loved, that you say that your father, like, later on admitted that he knew how devastated you were and how badly he felt about it. There seemed to be an understanding, an emotional understanding of you, maybe.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And to be fair to him, he never, ever said, oh, I could see how upsetting it was to you. Well, that's your mum's fault because she moved to America. Right. He never actually said that, you know.
Right.
So, you know, there wasn't much spite in my dad. He wasn't really a very bitter person at all. He did kind of pick himself up and brush himself down and move on in life, which I think I still think of as quite an admirable quality. You know, I mean, maybe don't be quite so fucking selfish and expect everybody else to behave the same way. And, you know, the tricky part is that, yes, he got me, you know, yes, he fought for me, yes, he got me. But I don't think he really understood how difficult it would be to raise a teenage girl without her mother around and the complications of that. And I think a lot of my kind of teenage promiscuity, basically, which, you know, he kind of pissed me off, you know, because he did sort of talk to other people about it and was going, oh, you know, Mickey's sleeping around and this, that and the other. I wasn't at the time at all, actually. But, you know, I felt that was a kind of betrayal. And there was a bit of me that thought, well, what the fuck did you expect? I mean, funny, but you've literally brought me up with this turnstile of women coming in and out of the house all the details of which you have shared with me, right? You've even taken me to nightclubs to help pick up women, right? I've watched you be this fucking shag monster. And there are literally no boundaries in my life, none. And now you're going to blame me for whatever the fuck I'm doing. Do you know what I mean? Because effectively, all I'm doing is kind of copying you.
You talk about being a teen and going to Japan and meeting your maternal grandmother, who you have such a nice bond with. And you say that the trips to Japan, where I'm surrounded by people who love me in a stable and happy environment, did me the world of good, which was very moving. I just love how you end the section of part one. You know, my father was a complicated, charismatic, alcoholic writer who had affairs, and Aaron's dad was a complicated, angry dad with explosive stuff at home. And I love that you say, even in this imperfect love, this infuriating, selfish, pernicious, problematic love, I'll take it and treasure it because it's infinitely better than no love at all. And my world is certainly emptier without his presence. That's you writing about your dad. I could cry, but it's just so beautiful.
I know. It's so moving at the end of his life. It's like you come full circle, and he gives you such a gift by basically in those last days telling you everything that he kind of knew, you know, about Nora, and apologizing to you, you know, because when you first tell him about the abuse, like a decade before that or something, and he's not ready to hear it yet, and he says, careful, that's my mother you're talking about. And that was so human, because that's the issue, right? Like, it's so hard for us to talk shit about our parents who we love and are very bonded to. It's heartbreaking, but I'm so glad that he had you and you had him, because the love was real.
For sure, you know, and I do think that there is, I mean, it's quite interesting. I was talking to someone who's like a grief counselor, right?
Yeah.
This is a little aside here, but, you know, she was saying that I get, you know, people who come in and they're talking about they've lost their mother or whatever, and they will sit there and talk about their mother and go on about what a saint she was and how amazing and this loss and blah, blah, blah. And she says, I have to wait and try and encourage them to try and talk about some of the negatives, right? And she said it feels like a real betrayal for them. But she was saying they're not going to be able to kind of get on with their lives until they admit the whole person. Because there's a bit of me, you know, I do get asked about my dad. You know, he died in 2010, I think. And I do miss him. I miss the best of him. But I also know that probably, given the trajectory of his politics, that he would probably now be like a fucking Trump supporter. I mean, Hungary is undergoing quite a weird time with Viktor Orban in charge, and, you know, that's quite right wing and all of that. We would doubtless have fallen out over a multitude of things, you know, because he could be a real fucking arsehole as well. But I do think it's the complete picture of someone. You know, you can love the great bits in them and you can take that. But of course, there's going to be negatives. And there are things that my dad did that, you know, certainly when I had children of my own, you know, you suddenly get that perspective where you think, I cannot believe that my dad did this. You know, I wouldn't think of doing that for a moment with my own children, you know, and then you sort of judge them for certain things that they did, you know, but to demonize someone completely for that, I think is, I mean, maybe selfishly, I don't want to let go of him as a full person, because there are really good things about him and there are things that are in me that are him, you know.
Right. Maybe that you're a natural fucking writer.
He was a very good raconteur. You know, there's a kind of a, this is like a, quite a funny example of my dad's selfishness, but also craziness. I didn't actually put this in the book, but in the 80s, he embarked on this sort of friendship where he was writing some book about, I don't know, there was this kind of tech millionaire guy called George Kogar. I had to look him up on Wikipedia, but I think he was sort of someone recognized. I remember going to Spain. My dad had a flat in Spain and meeting this guy. He was this American and he was kind of odd, but my dad got quite enamored of him in that he was going to write his book. He was very engaged with him. He felt like this could be like a big deal for him. And he got quite friendly with George Koga. And there's this mad thing that he was into like cryogenics.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, my dad said, you know, he offered me like he was going to do this thing where he was going to vanish and get himself frozen or whatever the fuck, right? And my dad was talking about this thing that he was like, oh, he wanted me to be part of this. He was getting people into it. And the thing is, if you look him up, he actually vanished, like his private plane went down in like 1983 and nobody knows what wow. happened to him.
Wow.
And it's a mystery. There was like 8 people on the plane or something and they've never been found.
And he's now frozen.
Well, we don't know. My dad was convinced that basically he faked this disappearing plane and that somewhere he's like frozen in this cryogenic thing. And he was a bit like, I feel like I missed out on that, like I should have done it, you know. And I remember sort of seeing it going like, okay, so great for me. Like, okay, so you were just going to fucking die in a plane crash and leave me on my fucking own. Fuck. And also, what the hell are you talking about? Because, you know, typical Ivan, he was like, well, you know, this idea that we could be reborn in a future where, you know, you can live forever and they'll have cures for all these things and, you know, and that we'll be like these celebrities because we'll come out of this frozen state. And I was like, I mean, I'm not being funny, but I've read a lot of dystopian sci-fi in my time. And I was going, okay, or... Yeah. Like World War III breaks out and people forget to turn the fucking power on. And you were just like melting into a pool of slurry. And what the fuck are you talking about? This is insane. But the fact that this was a serious regret. I said, I know you like an adventure, but fuck me. You are fucking right out there.
Yeah, you have children.
Mm.
How old are your kids?
22 and 19.
Wow. Did they know your dad? Did they have a relationship with your father?
You know, I'm trying to think how old they were. I mean, they were under 10 when he died.
Yeah.
And, you know, my dad was appalling when, like, I got pregnant. He was fucking terrible, right? Like, you know, I kind of told him, hey, you know, we emailed a lot. So I emailed him and I said, look, I'm going to have a baby. You know, me and Misa are going to have a baby. And I didn't hear from him for like 4 days or something. This is when I didn't have a computer at home, right? It's a work computer.
Yeah.
So I fucking go into work on the Monday and there's like this series of emails, right, that have been written at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever, where he was just fucking slagging off. What are you doing? You're throwing your life away. Moose is like not the right person for you. Blah, 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 blah. I've told my friends and they think it's a really bad idea. And I was like, you know what? Fuck you. And I didn't even reply. I just thought I'm going to let him stew on that and wait to see what he comes back with. You know, it's not even worthy of a reply. But, you know, I'm not going to lie. I was hurt.
Mm.
But I mean, again, a lot of people sort of make a big deal about the book and say like, oh, it's so honest and blah, blah, blah. This is how I talk, right? Everything in the book is stuff that I talk about. It's not like some buried thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did talk to a lot of my friends and I, you know, and I was like, well, I just thought, you know what? You claim to want me to be with someone who's more solvent. Or, you know, I don't know, what do you want me to do? Like be married to some stockbroker? You did not bring me up to live that lifestyle. You know, we have a certain lifestyle. It might not be that financially secure. You may object to Moose because he's a musician and he isn't, you know, the successful fucking whatever you think that I deserve or need. But you're not listening to what I want, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I want. And I'm having a baby. And if you don't want to be fucking delighted about that, then that's your loss. And actually, when my children were born, he wasn't great with them. You know, he was very critical and, oh, well, the girl is very clingy and, you know, and blah, 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 and this, that and the other. And again, I was like, well, you know, it's a shame. You know, this is your loss. You know, you don't have to be this defensive about it. He didn't really want to make the effort. And I did feel like, this is about you.
Mm.
What you're pissed off about is that you feel like you haven't got me anymore. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? There's a sort of jealousy in there, which I just thought was pathetic. I mean, I fucking named my son after him. Wow. And that was actually Moose's idea, right? It wasn't even my idea. Wow. And an effort to try and engage him a little bit. And right near the end, he did soften and he did get it. But, you know, I mean, I loved my dad and there were many great things about him, but he could be a fucking awkward bugger sometimes. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And really, I just thought it was a very self-defeating attitude. I thought he was better than that. So it was disappointing, you know. But I was willing to wait for him to come around to it. I mean, to be honest, I just wasn't going to engage with it because I just thought, okay, well, fuck you. You know, my kids are actually more important to me. So if you're going to be an arsehole about it, then ring me when you've got over yourself. I'll be there. Okay. You know,
like. Did your father think that having, I know the implication is like, when so many words, that guy, you know, where's the stockbroker? Like that guy about Moose, maybe? About you having a baby, but also, did he feel like you were hurting your music career? Like, was he proud of Lush and was he proud of your success there and touring and all of that stuff? How did your parents and your father specifically react to your career?
I mean, I think my dad, you know, this is not an uncommon thing, right? My mother was always incredibly supportive. She was delighted. You know, she'd come along to the gigs and she'd meet all the people. After her acting career, she went into like the world of fashion and photography. So she was very used to that kind of world of entertainers and blah, 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 you know. And she was quite comfortable and at home in it. And she would come along to the gigs and everyone was like, oh, your mum's so great, you know. My dad, I think, was a bit, like I say, you can have a parent who is incredibly ambitious for you, but it always has to be their fucking way. You know, you always fall short and, you know, they're kind of slightly critical to you. They fucking rave about you behind your back, right? Yeah. When their friends are like, oh, how's Mickey? Oh, amazing. She's got a front cover of this and blah, blah, blah. But when you're talking face to face with them, they're like, well, you know, I don't really understand why you don't do this or you don't, you know, some ignorant bullshit that they're trying to advise you on your career. And you're like, okay, you don't have the first idea of what I'm actually doing here. So just shut the fuck up. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, my dad's attitude was, you know, the irony is that if I had married some fucking banker or some tech fucking billionaire or something, he would have been hypercritical of them as well and gone, well, I don't understand why you married this stiff, you know. He was always someone who retrospectively would talk about my boyfriends and go, well, I don't know why you didn't stay with John. He was a great guy. And I'm like, okay, well, at the time you were like, he's like some ticking Swiss watch. He's kind of dull and what, and you know what I mean? The goalposts are always move because, and I kind of get the impetus is that that person wants you to be amazing and wants you to have the best life. There's also a vanity of it that it's like, well, is this about me or is this about you? Right. So you can brag about this. It's kind of mixed up. You know, there is a concern. Are you sure that this is the right life for you? I can see where the problems might happen. And you go, I know, but this is what I'm going to do. So just fucking get on board with it. Stop kicking against it because I am going to do this. And your fucking criticism is not going to make an ounce of difference. It's just going to irritate me.
Spoken like a true daughter. That's rock and roll. Okay, so eventually one thing happens at school. You meet your bandmate, Emma Anderson, right? And you guys become friends and end up starting this band, Lush, with Chris Acland on drums and Phil King on bass.
It was Steve Rippon on bass. So he was the first bass player. And we also had Mariel Barham. She was the first singer in Lush. So it was five of us.
But when you meet Chris, I feel like his presence is like, he renews your faith in men. Well, I guess just talk about the birth of Lush a little bit and how you guys came up, you know, shoegaze, dream pop, My Bloody Valentine, starting to play guitar.
I mean, to be fair, like, I don't think Chris revived my faith in men. I always liked men a lot. You know, I always got on with blokes a lot, you know, certain kinds of blokes. You know, I had a few wrong turns, I think. But, you know, even some of the wrong turns, you know, I think I was lucky is the wrong word, really. You know, I was attracted to men who have got something, you know, a fucking personality, you know, and maybe a bit maverick as well. And that is obviously, you know, my dad was a very maverick and funny person. And because I'd spent so much time around him, there was a kind of acceptance. Like, I knew how shitty men could be. I wasn't naive. I know how men can cheat. I know when I'm being manipulated because I've fucking seen my dad do it. I know the lines that they fucking use. I've seen it all. Mm. So I think, I mean, the thing with Chris is he was just such a sweetheart. He was a really open book and there was no side to him at all. Yeah. He was genuinely a very friendly, sweet person. And I think it always seems so weird because if somebody dies, you know, everybody's full of the eulogies about how wonderful they were. But I genuinely think, you know, Chris was, and everybody liked him.
That comes through.
I mean, you know, me and Emma met at school. We met when we were about 14. We became friends. It was a little circle of us girls at school. I think a lot of our bonding was that it was a private school. And I've talked about this in that I think sometimes people assume that if you went to private school, you're like, you know, lords and ladies. And there is a hierarchy at private schools. You know, there's the very rich people who have got the country houses and the skiing holidays. And then there's an awful lot of people whose parents kind of scrape the money together to send them there. Now, I don't want to play it down. It's a privilege, right? You know, it's still a private bloody school. But I think in the microcosm of that, we felt like you are on the bottom rung, right? You know, and so I think a lot of our rebellion, because we couldn't afford to go to balls and we couldn't afford the fancy designer clothes and the whatever, we rebelled by, you know, I don't know, you get your haircut for free at Vidal Sassoon, or you wear army gear, or you become a punk, or you become a goth, or whatever the fuck you become, because actually that's a separate identity and you're not competing. You're not less than, you know, that was the problem with that school, is that if you try and, you know, if you're going to like high street shops to buy your clothes, you just look less than other people. So if you're going to do that, you might as well just go fucking full pelt the other way and form an identity that isn't even on the ranking system. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so we got into music and we were really, in a very juvenile way, actually, you know, very, it was, I think my mate Maxine described it as hormonal. A lot of our interest in music was, you know, this obsessiveness and these crushes and, you know, there was just this whole world in it. And I think, I guess me and Emma kind of, we were the ones that followed through with that and actually then, you know, took it further and formed a band. But it was very easy to fall into that at the time. We were lucky. We lived in London. It was a very vibrant time. There was a huge, I mean, you could go to a gig every night of the week. And sometimes we did, you know, and there was a whole social life around that. We did a fanzine together because everyone was writing a fucking fanzine. There was a very high unemployment. So there was a lot of people, you know, being quite creative and creating this sort of subculture. It wasn't like, you know, it didn't feel like a pipe dream because half the people you met were in bands or they had a stall, you know, making their own clothes and selling them at Portobello Market, or they were doing bootleg tapes and selling them at Camden, or opening a venue or running a club or whatever the fuck they were doing. You know, it was loads of people involved and we were just part of that kind of sweep, really.
Yeah. And in 1992, you have a couple of albums out, Spooky. And did Split come out after Lollapalooza? You go on tour. You and Emma are the only ladies in the game.
Well, we were the only women who were kind of in a band and performing. I mean, you know, there were dancers and there were, you know, managers and, you know, tour personnel and all of that.
I'll just read off the headliners. Red Hot Chili Peppers, Ministry, Ice Cube, Soundgarden, Jesus and Mary Chain, and Pearl Jam. So there's a lot of funny stories of, you know, male-dominated rock shenanigan douchebag adventures. Yeah, I guess just talk a little bit about that because, you know, there's the misogyny, well-tread territory of the 90s and forever, but also the casual racism that you face as a biracial Japanese person and the makeup artist not knowing what quite to do. And,
you know, I always felt like being part Japanese was, you know, even being part Hungarian. I remember when I was at school in Windsor, like people didn't even know what Hungary was, you know. It's like,
interesting,
you know, so, but, you know, you're an immigrant. And I think I kind of just ignored most of it. Like, there were occasional jarring moments where it was sort of brought home to you. But I spent most of the time just ignoring it, you know, and just blocking it out because it just didn't serve me any purpose. You know, some people are quite racist, you know, and they just will be, you know, they're just, that's who they are. And they want to have a go at you. And it's not pleasant. But those times were relatively rare. And there were times when people were kind of, you know, now we would say that that's a racist thing to say or whatever. I mean, I can remember like some boy at school once saying like, well, you're quite pretty, but because you're foreign, it's difficult to tell, you know, like you're not really on the scale, are you? You know, I mean, he didn't say scale because he was probably 10 years old, but do you know what I mean? And I remember finding that quite jarring. But at the same time, it's a fucking 10-year-old kid. He's never met anyone from Japan. Do you know what I mean? Like, the fuck? You know, it's pointless getting upset about it. And, you know, there's a sense that you're kind of, you feel a bit othered. You know, there were very well-meaning parents who, if I got invited round for tea, they'd be sitting there going, oh, well, Japanese culture's marvellously interesting, actually, isn't it? You know, they've got some very unique art. And I'd be like, you probably know more about it than I do. I have no clue. Like, you know, and I don't think I ever really got offended by that because I could tell when people were trying to be nice. It just sort of, you know, and it is worthy of comment. You know, people did, they were curious and I didn't really take offense at that. You know, you can tell when it's negative. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that the times when I would be sort of exoticized, but again, you know, I just took the piss. I remember some guy going to me about, oh, well, you know, Japanese women are, well, I can't even remember what the fuck he said. You know, it was some sort of, you know, these exotic creatures with their almond eyes or whatever the fuck, right?
Right.
And I just sat there and burped in his face and went like, yeah, whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's whatever you're saying is fucking nonsense. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, I just didn't really have any time for it because to me, I think that the race issue, I genuinely did just ignore it. And partly there was a bit of me also that felt it's much harder for people who are actually darker skinned. Like I could see the racism towards if you're black, right?
Yeah.
That is actually clear. Like I have seen the National Front sit there and fucking want to deport people. That's not the experience of someone who is half Hungarian and half Japanese. They just think it's weird, really.
Yeah.
Once or twice I'd get a kind of, you know, I don't know, someone who felt that the Japanese were on the wrong side of the war and therefore were like, I mean, whatever, you know what I mean? You're just going to meet some ignorant people. And it didn't really bother me that much because I just thought it was fucking stupid. And it just didn't seem to matter to most of the people I was around. Like they didn't really comment on my Japanese-ness. And probably there was a certain amount of, you know, is that, I mean, is it denial? I didn't feel particularly Japanese because culturally I really wasn't. I just considered myself English because this is where I was raised. I'd be a fish out of water in Japan. As much as I love visiting my Japanese family, there's no way I could have lived there. It was a completely alien culture and their expectations of women. And, you know, they tolerated me because I was different. But if I'd have lived there, it would have been a nightmare for them. You know?
Yeah.
You know, because it was quite a sexist culture for a start. And, you know, even on Lollapalooza, I think that the use of the word misogyny now has just become replaceable with sexism. And I don't actually think it is. You know, misogyny is a very specific thing. And I have met people who really fucking don't like women, who expect women to be more stupid than they are, men, in other words, right? They want women to be less than, and they don't like it when they're not, right? And they're kind of even disgusted by women. You know, they think periods are disgusting, or they think, you know, whatever the fuck their preconceptions are, that's misogyny. sexism is just kind of, it's more sort of annoying. It's more, it certainly isn't like violence, and it isn't, you know, deliberate kind of, I'm going to fucking put you in your place. Mm-hmm. It's just stupid assumptions that are ignorant. And I do think people can be cured of that. You know, I mean, I'm being funny, but, you know, bless him, Chris, I loved him to bits. He had like certain sexist assumptions because all fucking people do, you know, lots of women do. Yeah. They think like, well, it's not natural for women to do that. And you're like, well, it is because I'm fucking doing it. And, you know, and I think with Lollapalooza, again, there was a whole spectrum of that. I did see men who I thought were quite predatory, and the way that they looked at women and the way that they, you know, got groupies or pursued girls and just wanted them to get their tits out and treated them like disposable trash. But I saw an awful lot of men who were, yeah, they're a bit macho, but, you know, they've got their fucking wife on tour, you know?
Yeah.
They're nice blokes. You know, the women are doing all the cleaning up and the looking after, but, you know, they clearly love the women in their lives and what have you. And that to me is just like, well, it's relatively harmless. At times it's just irritating. And I do think that obviously it wasn't just that I had, you know, like, oh my God, it was a very macho tour. And I would argue that a lot of those men might not behave individually, like in normal life, the way that they behave. But, you know, when you've got this fucking circus around you.
In 1992. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's boys on tour, you know, they're all going to fucking, they want to have a party. And it's like, well, what's wrong with having a few strippers in, you know? You know, and I'm like, well, I'm sorry. I just think it's fucking disgusting. So, you know, I'm not going to fucking play. But, and I get that thing where boys are like, oh, stop ruining it for us. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want to think about that. I'm like, well, okay. But I just think it's scuzzy and creepy and I don't like it. And a lot of the time it is about boys wanting to live out their little rock fantasies and think that there's nothing wrong with that. And they don't like some woman sitting there and fucking bursting their bubble and going, well, personally, I think that's actually out of order.
Well, the band breaks up because Chris dies. What year was that? 96?
96, yeah.
What was the aftermath of that? Feel like Lush had come to its natural conclusion then with his loss? Or,
I mean, I think, you know, I think we had a very difficult time when we made Love Life in the aftermath. We had management problems and all of that. But to be honest, when I think about it, you know, there's a lot of detail that has been kind of poured over in interviews with me and Emma, certainly when we did the reunion, you know, oh, this is why that happened and blah, blah, blah. To be honest, I actually think maybe it had just run its course. You know, it's a very different world we were operating in. I think that even when we did Lollapalooza, it was the foothills of alternative becoming the mainstream. But, you know, when we were doing Lollapalooza and those tours, it still was alternative. It was college radio. It was fanzines. It was a subculture. And at some point, you know, in the next few years, certainly by the time, you know, Nirvana's Nevermind came out, you know what I mean? Then it became, right, this is now the mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going to see Beck at a festival in 1997. And this was in Britain. It was just Essex lads throwing bottles of water at the stage. And I thought this would never have happened 5 years ago, right? This was, even when we did Lollapalooza, I mean, I thought we would get fucking crucified on that tour. I'm not going to lie.
Really?
And actually, we went out. People were really nice, you know?
Oh, yeah.
We didn't get bottled off. There was no one booing. You know, lots of people might not have been that interested, or they might have said like, yeah, they're kind of lame. But no one was abusive. No one was intolerant.
Good.
There was a kind of ethos of alternative music that you need to open your mind, right? That's just not cool behavior to sit there and I think they're shit and I'm going to fucking throw bottles at them. Not long after that started to happen, you know, certainly by the time we were doing those 1996 radio festivals, and that's when you had that kind of jock guys who are like, fuck this, I want to hear, you know, whoever the fuck I want to hear. Certainly not two English girls with, you know, some fey boys playing like indie music. It's like the school bullies come in and they're throwing their weight around. And that wasn't what alternative music was about. You know, actually, Kurt Cobain thought, Nothing Natural video. He thought it was amazing. You know, yeah. I had like fucking people who were in like death metal bands wearing Lush t-shirts. There was a coolness to liking different kinds of music. It wasn't this monoculture and intolerance. And unfortunately, right. although there's a lot more money, clearly, when you make it big, then you're inviting the normies in who don't really care about music. You know, yeah. they just want their fucking tribe. And they want to be, and I want to hear what I want to hear, and I don't want to hear anything else. You know, that's why I got involved in indie music in the first place, because it was like a whole world of different kinds of music. I could listen to anything and meet different people, and it was a melting pot. And then at that point, by the time the band split up, and it got way worse, you know, you only have to look at that kind of, what was it, that Woodstock 99 to see where that ended up.
Yeah, good point.
So I think that really, I can remember actually talking to Mark Gardner from Ride, you know, and I, because when Chris died, that was it, I was out. I didn't really know what was going on with other bands. But it's interesting yeah. that Ride split up around that time. Slow Dive split up around that time. You know, a lot of those bands either got dropped by their labels because they were never going to be Nirvana.
The next,
you know?
Yeah.
So I do think that it probably would have ended anyway. And certainly Emma wanted out. I mean, I think she was very sick of the treadmill aspect of it. My outlook was that I kind of suspected that she just wanted to start another band. You know, like she would have been happy to have started a band with Chris and Phil, but just not me. And my thing was like, well, we can all go off and do our own things, but it's never going to be what Lush is.
Mm, right.
And I stand by that still. That is yeah. true. So I think she had already had enough. I did fight to sort of, my memory was that I said, look, let's just make another album. I will make whatever fucking album you want. Okay. But I do think we should give it another shot. And then Chris died. And I think when that happened, I thought, okay, that's it. I definitely can't do this band without Chris. So, you know, then I was like, yeah, no, fair enough. That's the end. I mean, it was devastating on a personal level. It was my first major death. You know, my grandmother died when I was 18 or something. And I didn't really give a shit. I wasn't even happy.
Right.
It was just a thing that happened off stage. But I think when Chris died, it absolutely fucking tore me to pieces.
Well, you're still playing music now. And you've got the Mickey Brenny Trio. And you're playing some shows in America. What can you tell us?
You know, I'm going to be 57 in about...
What?
Is it next week, right?
I don't believe it.
Yeah.
I don't believe it. You're a baby.
And there is a bit of me that's like, okay, so... This is it. Last throw of the dice. Because, you know, I wrote the book and people are like, are you going to write another book? And I'm like, okay, I might not. I have no idea. But at the moment, I just feel like I just want to make some music because I do actually feel there's going to come a point where I just can't be fucking bothered to go on tour because, you know, it's not like what I'm doing. It's not like I get fucking paid a fortune when I go on tour and it's like some luxury experience. It really is for the love of it. And I think, you know, even arranging this American tour, which to be honest, really came from the Shellraiser Festival just giving us an offer that meant it was enough money to actually sort the fucking visas. Because for anyone listening who doesn't understand how fucking expensive and what an absolute nightmare it is to try and get over to America and play, like, bless all those people who go, oh, can you come to, like, you know, North Carolina, or could you not come to Dallas and whatever? I would love to, but the organization, and honestly, it would be easier to play a fucking gig in Mordor, right? Getting into America to play shows is, I cannot tell you how difficult it is. You know, so basically Shellraiser offered this thing and thought, okay, fine, we can get the visa. So then we built a tour around it. And I'm really looking forward to it. When I'm on that tour, I'm going to have a great time. But fuck me, it's a headache. And there is a bit of me that thinks, like I say, I'm going to be 57 next week. If it's going to be this hard, there's no way I'm doing this when I'm 60. I'm going to be like, it's fine. I'm just going to do some gardening at home and cook some bread or whatever the fuck it is that pensioners do. Like, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, listeners, you've heard it here. If you want to see Mickey Brenny play live again in America, come to the shows now, because this may be it.
do put that message out there.
Well, thank you so much for writing the book. Yeah, and thank you for still holding a guitar and writing lyrics and just being out there. And you're incredible. A total hero.
Yes.
A rock hero.
Yes. A rock hero.
A literary hero.
A literary rock just hero.
Thank you. No problem.
It was really good fun. Thank you.
Well, it's such a good book. Thank you for sharing your story with the world.
This podcast was created and produced by Aaron Hosier, Elizabeth Thompson, and Matthew Philp. You can always listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google, and anywhere you get your shows. Follow us at Tell Me About Your Father on Instagram and Facebook. Subscribe to our bi-weekly newsletter that accompanies new episodes at tellmeaboutyourfather.com. And Apple Podcasts is like the New York Times book review of platforms. So if you can, go there to rate and review us. We'd love to hear what you think.